I'd like to call this meeting to order. Let the record reflect, the time is 12:02. Today is Thursday, March 2nd, 2006. Present, we have Representative Wilson Dahlstrom. We're honored to have Mrs. Murkowski here as a guest, and myself, Chair Newman. We do not have a quorum today, but we are hearing a presentation, and we will not be hearing legislation. So I think we can move forward on that issue. We do have some folks that are over in resources right now, quite busy on oil tax stuff. Today, the committee is pleased to welcome the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Task Force, who will be making a presentation on early childhood education. Again, we're not going to be hearing any legislation today or introducing legislation. So it is an honor to introduce Mrs. Murkowski, the chair of the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Blue Ribbon Task Force. At this time, I'll turn the program over to her for introduction of the speakers. Let the record reflect, we've also been joined by Representative Gatto for a short time.
Just to notice that resources runs over everything these days. But I did want to come in and say hi.
Thank you, sir, and we'll make sure you get a copy of the presentation. Mrs. Murkowski.
Thank you. This has been a really invigorating, enlightening task force. We have a group of very prestigious Alaskans that are working with us. Would you all like to stand up just so people can identify you all?
Please do.
And thank you. Thank you very much. We had discovered that too many Alaskan children are entering kindergarten unable to read and, more importantly, unable to learn. So the task force was committed to changing the picture. Our vision is that every child entering kindergarten will be ready to read and ready to learn, which is the most important part of the aspect. I'm not going to comment any further on any of the other things we're doing until later, but I'd like to introduce our first guest, and that is Robert Grunwald from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. He's speaking on economic development with a high public return, early childhood education. Thank you for coming all the way from Minneapolis and joining us in this beautiful day of sunshine.
You're welcome.
Please state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Rob Grunwald. I'm an associate economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Chairman Newman and First Lady Murkowski.
Thank you, Rob.
I will be presenting a paper briefly entitled Early Childhood Development, Economic Development with a High Public Return. It's co-authored by myself and Art Rolnick, who is our Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Now, before I begin introducing the concepts in this paper, I must explain, you know, what is the Federal Reserve doing talking about very young children? Well, the Federal Reserve, of course, is our central bank in the United States. We're responsible for managing the money supply. And the Federal Reserve Bank, we have 12 offices. You're part of the 12th district, actually the San Francisco Fed, oversees the operations here in Alaska. But we have a diverse and wide-ranging research program. And one of the areas of research that we tend to focus on is what are the aspects of economic growth, what are the ingredients of economic growth necessary to have a strong and growing economy from a national perspective, at a regional level, at a state level. One of the key ingredients to a growing economy is the quality of the workforce. And about 4 or 5 years ago at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, we dug into the literature about the impact that high-quality workforce, looking at the quality of the workforce, has on economic growth. We first looked at the literature from an international perspective and looked at those countries that showed strong economic growth over the last 40 years. We saw that one of the key ingredients to their economic success, and here I'm referring to the Asian tiger economies such as Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, these economies all invested in their human capital systems, in their school systems. Also, we look at the states in the United States. Those states that have a high percent of population with a college degree also tend to be those states that have higher output per person and also high per capita income. In the economy that we now have, there is a growing premium that is paid to those workers that have more skills. We call this the wage premium in economics. And if we look at those workers with a college degree relative to those workers with a high school degree, we see that there is a 70% difference in wages between those two groups of workers. about 20 or 25 years ago, that difference was only about 40%. And if we look at those workers with only a high school degree or who have dropped out of high school, over the last 15 years, we have not seen increases in their inflation-adjusted wages. And in fact, among those workers that have dropped out of high school, these are workers that have seen decreases in their inflation-adjusted wages. So quality of the workforce is key to economic growth. It's one of our key assets. I know Alaska has tremendous amounts of natural resources as assets, but you also have a workforce here from which to build on. It's also a very key asset for this state and all of our states in the country. So the policy implications are clear to invest in our schools, in our colleges and universities. And 4 and 5 years ago, when Art Wolnick and I started looking at human capital research, that was the end of our policy recommendation. But that soon changed once we became exposed to the research on early childhood development. Particularly, you're going to hear about some of the neuroscience and research from the next speaker. But what I want to talk about is some economic research that has been conducted looking at what happens during these early years if children who are on a trajectory towards developmental delays, not succeeding in school, essentially children who are at risk, receive a high-quality preschool program and parent support program in their early years. And when we reviewed this literature, we found that there was not only a human capital story, where this is a key period for which children begin their pathways towards becoming a productive citizen in the country and in the workforce, but we also found that there was a public good story. Indeed, there is a high public return to an investment in early education. We came to these conclusions by looking at four key studies. I'm just going to review one of these studies briefly for you. This is the HiSCOPE study of the Perry Preschool Program. It's a program that started in the early 1960s. 123 children from low-income families were selected in Ypsilanti, Michigan to participate in the study. It's just outside of Detroit. The children were randomly selected to attend the Perry Preschool or to be in a control group for comparison. Those children who attended the Perry Preschool not only had a high-quality daily session in the classroom, but the teacher visited the home to work with that child's mother on parenting skills during the week. And the researchers were able to track the participants and the control group over a 40-year period of time. And here are some of the results of this study. They found educational effects, significant differences in achievement scores during school, also significant differences between graduation rates, and also a reduced need to require special education. Then the researchers tracked the children and the participants until they were 40 years old. They found that the children who graduated from Perry were more likely to own their own home. Because they had higher levels of education, they earned more money in the workforce. And I included this last piece of information because I am from the Federal Reserve. They were more likely to have a savings account.
Good.
The large public benefits that were found from this program came from the reductions in crime. All levels of crime, misdemeanors to felonies, were essentially, the crime rates for those crimes were reduced by about half. This resulted in reductions in about a year and a half on average spent in prison. So we see that there are benefits to these programs. Some of them are private benefits to the children. They earn more money in the workforce later on. But many of these public benefits are public. What the researchers were then able to do was conduct a benefit or a cost-benefit analysis, look at the cost of this program relative to the benefits. The cost of this program in today's dollars, about $10,000 per child. On average, they spent a year and a half in this program. We see the savings to the K-12 system, as I mentioned before, the reductions in special education. Higher participant earnings, most of that are private benefits. Some of it is public because we have higher tax revenue. Then we see the reductions to the need for expenditure in the criminal justice system and also reductions to the victims of crime. So if we put the benefits in relationship to the cost, we see there's a $17 in total benefits returned for every dollar that's invested. The annual rate of this return, if we adjust it to an interest rate, is 18%. Most of the benefits are public. We estimate the public return at 16%, very high rate of return to this program. there are three other early childhood programs that have a similar type of research structure. The Abecedarian program, the Chicago Child Parent program, are preschool programs. Abecedarian program started at just a few months old until the age of five. Chicago, 3 and 4 years old. These programs also show strong rates of return. At the bottom, I also included a prenatal counseling program that showed that the children in this program performed better as they grew older as well. Just briefly, I'm going to talk about some of the lessons that were learned from this research. It was important to invest in quality early childhood programs. Qualifications of the teachers are very important, for example, including the parents is very key. Having parents, of course, as their first teachers. Reaching the at-risk population is where the highest return comes from, because here's where we can solve future problems most readily. The importance of including not only emerging literacy and numeracy skills, but also social and emotional skills. And the importance to find ways to bring these type of programs to scale to reach many children in our communities. Now, the next few slides I'll just leave for your consumption. They're basically a laundry list of opportunities to think about. These are just some areas that you could look at in terms of improving awareness, and also areas that future investments could be made, such as early childhood screening, improving childcare quality, and access to preschool. Particularly for at-risk children, prenatal counseling, also connecting child protection services with early childhood intervention programs, and be ensure that children who are from low-income families have access to early childhood programs.
And Rob, I'd like to just interject real quick. We have been joined for the record by Senator Ellis, Representative Guerra, and Senator Betty Davis in the audience. Proceed, Rob.
Thank you. And the final slide I want to share with you is that this analysis, looking at the rates of return to these programs, has been effective in bringing other people who have not thought about, like myself, who have not thought about early childhood as a human capital development program to the table, business leaders, economists. And these are groups not only through the country, the Committee for Economic Development, United Way Success by Six program are a couple initiatives that included a number of business leaders on this issue. PNC Financial Services is an example of a company that has raised $100 million to put forward towards early education over the next 10 years in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But finally, just to mention Minnesota Business for Early Learning. This is a group in Minnesota, another cold weather state, that has 200 members, many of them representing businesses in our community. About a year ago, this group looks very similar to the task force that is here before you today, coming before you to talk about the partnership that they want to make with the state here in Alaska in order to leverage resources from the private sector, from community leaders, with the state to explore how to most cost-effectively help Alaskans with early childhood development. And let me say, in the last year, this has been a very fruitful partnership in Minnesota between the state of Minnesota and our own business leaders. If you would like more resources, of course, there's our website, MinneapolisFed.org. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Rob.
And thank you, Rob. And may I say, who better to talk about the value of early education than a banker?
Absolutely.
Mr. Murkowski.
Yes, the task force has been looking at other programs all over the country. We've been doing a lot of research on the ones in Michigan and Minnesota as well. One thing you may not know, some of you who are not with the task force, is that Alaska is one of 12 states of the entire country that does not have an early childhood development program. So we're way behind everybody else, but we're working on it. Our next speaker, welcome Bridget, is Bridget Chandler from the Washington State Governor's Early Learning Council. She's going to speak on the significance of child brain development. Bridget spoke to us once before, and she's absolutely fascinating. So, Bridget, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Murkowski. I'll do my best to live up to that.
Please state your name for the record, Bridget.
I'm Bridget Chandler from the Washington State Governor's Early Learning Council. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and distinguished guests. It is a real pleasure to be back in Alaska. I had the good fortune to participate in a statewide summit under 2 years ago, And then to see a Blue Ribbon Task Force pulled together, drawing from all sectors across the state to address this really important opportunity that you have to do, as the First Lady mentioned, catch up with what other states in the country are doing. The great thing about catching up is that you get to learn from the experience of the other states ahead of you. And in Washington State, we're not all that much ahead of you, but we're a little bit ahead of you. What's very impressive in terms of your progress is that once you decided to get going, you have made really remarkable strides. And I would stress, in terms of the nature of the public-private partnership that you're pulling together, that's a lesson that many people like to say that they are committed to, but not everyone can pull it off. And you've got a really impressive track record so far. So really encourage you to carefully consider how the state can join this partnership in order to move forward in the way that is really appropriate for a state agency to do, or a new state agency. We can talk a little bit about Washington's experience. And you can take it or leave it, just as we have done with other states. So I'm here primarily to be a bridge from the scientific world to talk about what are these findings from neuroscience that are relevant for policymakers and for the lay public at large. And how is it that we can look to the world of neuroscience just as we can now look to the world of economy and human capital development to hear this story of early childhood development and why it is so important for us to step up to this opportunity that we have to not squander the enormous empathy and creativity that we all have as our birthright. So I want to talk about just some of the highlights from neuroscience and really try and capture this story of, you know, what is the technology enabling us to understand about why these early years are so precious, and what is it that we know about what really works best in those years from birth until school entry. What's new now is that we have technology that permits us to really look inside the brain and to look inside a healthy human brain while it's conducting various kinds of tasks. Now, most of our knowledge of the brain really has come in the last 10 years or so. And while it's not new that we can see how rapidly a child's brain develops in those first years of life, I mean, we all can imagine that toddler and look at the relationship of that toddler's head to the rest of their body. It's enormous. It's huge. You know, so we have that experience. We can see with our own eyes how the brain is growing so rapidly in those first couple years of life. But what the technology is allowing us to appreciate now is the rate of connection of brain cells and how underdeveloped our human brain is at birth. And that's very unusual from all of the other animals on the planet. So while we are born with our DNA that pretty much tells us what rate of development and the sequence of development in our brain, what really matters is what happens in our early experiences in terms of the quality of that brain development. So the quick takeaway on that is brains are developing so rapidly in those first years of life, and that the connections are growing in those first years of life. And most importantly, those initial circuits that get laid down, this very complex pattern of electrical and chemical interchanges that happen in our brain, those early circuits that get established are the foundation for all of the later learning that we do in our life. So we'll talk a little bit about what we know about that foundation and what makes it strong and what makes it shaky and how much work the brain has to do to catch up if we didn't get a good start in those early years, particularly birth to one. And we'll talk about what we know from some of the research there. So neuroscience, in many ways, is the unlikely messenger saying that, you know, one of the most important aspects of our development is the nurturing relationships and the quality of caring that we receive that permits us to take advantage of this innate drive that we have to explore our world. I mean, babies want to explore their world with all of their senses. I mean, we all have that experience of seeing children. They want to cram everything in their mouth. They want to touch things over and over and over again until they have that experience of mastery. And that really comes from our genes, the DNA that we got from our mom and from our dad. But how well we learn and the rate at which we'll continue to learn and how well those connections in our brain will be formed and be retained is really driven by our environment. What are those experiences that the grown-ups who love us and care for us have made available to us? What have we learned from the people around us is important to our development. So our brain is very undeveloped at birth. We humans are dependent on each other. We learn in relationship for a very long time relative to other brains on the planet. So this old story of, is it nature or is it nurture? Is it genes that determine who you're going to be, or is it experience that determines who you're going to be? That's an obsolete argument. It really has been buried once and for all. The best answer I heard to how much is genes and how much is experience is, it's 100% genes and 100% experience. That's my kind of math. So what's really important for us is to look at those nurturing relationships. And, you know, well, what kind of evidence do we have that shows the difference between a brain that has been nurtured and a brain that has really experienced a lot of chaos or harm? And this is just another way to look inside the brain and see this dazzling rate of early development. And this is a healthy pattern of brain development. If you look at that first slide, you can see the cells that have already reached out and started to connect. Those little dendrites, those little branchy bits, you know, are reaching out by nature, wanting to connect to the axons or the receiving ends of other brain cells. And the rate at which that happens in the early years is unparalleled compared to any other time in our life. So from birth to six, there's actually another slide that I could have put in there that would be a little bit harder to read, but would show you in a much denser thicket at age 2 or 3 years old. And in one of those rare instances where the science and the poetry of the moment are absolutely in sync, neuroscientists call that phase of development of 2 to 3 year old synaptic exuberance. My husband defined that in our daughter's life as all the lights are on and everybody's home all the time. And that's true. That's by nature. Our DNA tells us, reach out, explore everything, touch everything, smell everything, try everything. And then, even before we get to kindergarten, at 6 years or 5 years, whenever we start school, our brain has already started making lots of decisions about what's important. Which of those connections am I going to preserve, and which are not important anymore, and am I going to let wither away? And that's where the nurturing experience comes in. That's where it's so critically important for us to be very mindful of what's the array of experiences that all of our children have access to before they enter school, because that's where the trajectory is getting set. Okay, so again, neuroscience is kind of the unlikely messenger telling us that it's parents that matter. You know, it's really parents that matter the most. They are the first and most important teachers. Neuroscience also happily tells us that if we don't get what we need from our parents, our brains can reach out and get those experiences from others as well. But there is a special connection that the parents can offer that the neuroscience is now very, very clear about underscoring. So when we talk about early childhood programs and we talk about all the kinds of interventions that can be so helpful, we must never lose sight of the fact that it really is the parents who form that first most important experience for children. That relationship is the environment in which the brain develops. And so, you know, what we're learning from the science is that, you know, that emotional climate is the most important aspect of development. So we have our DNA, our genes, that are going to predispose us to be good at some things and maybe have challenges in other things. And it's that environment that allows the genes to do what scientists call express themselves. And if that environment is characterized overwhelmingly by stress, by your needs not being met, your basic needs for nutrition, for warmth, for comfort, for a responsive, interactive relationship that's not too stimulating but isn't neglectful, if you don't get that, even as a baby, your body will enter into a stress response system. And too much stress too early that happens too young in life is toxic to children's brains. And we have very, very clear research about that. So when we're looking at where to put our resources, where they're going to make the most difference, looking as early as we can on the scale will help to set that trajectory in a healthy way. And the reason we care about that, we care about literacy, we care about numeracy, and in order to care about gains there, we have to understand the foundation on which literacy and numeracy rests, and it really is our social and our emotional health. We used to think of infant mental health as an oxymoron. I mean, babies are happy. How can you talk about mental health with an infant? But we now have very compelling research data that shows us how infants, six-month-olds, can be depressed, mm-hmm. you know, when they're not receiving nurturing care and responsive interactions.
And Bridget, I'd just like to interject here. Could you give us a couple examples of how parents, and the parents that are in this room and the parents that are watching this, how can we interject some of those more positive aspects on the child at this age? What are some good examples?
Such a great question. You know, I would say first and foremost, if the parent can come to the relationship with their child full of confidence of the power of the love that they have for their child, Now, that sounds very airy-fairy, but I hope you all got goosebumps when I said that. I mean, we know what that experience is of being in a relationship where someone lets us know that we're loved. Much of it has to do with being able to take the time to be with your children, to be responsive to your child's individual needs. While we all have certain things that we share in common in terms of our growth trajectory, we're all individuals. And so the ability of a parent to really see what interests you. You know, you're trying to express something to me, even as an infant can recall their mother's voice. They'll pick their mother's voice out of other strangers' voices and orient toward that. They know their mother's smell. They know dad's voice as well, although they're a little bit better at picking out mom's because they've heard mom's voice in utero. So building on that natural connection that we have and understanding that a child has much to communicate to us long before they can speak. So that notion of being in an interactive relationship, being curious about what baby's trying to tell me is a big leap forward even from what advice my mother got when she had her five children. And I'm not that old, but my mom was told by her pediatrician who knew the received wisdom of the day that children are born blind and deaf. Now, that's not true. And happily, there were many researchers who were helping to prove that, no, that isn't the case. Children can see and hear at birth, and they have plenty going on upstairs. So it's really helping to set that trajectory in a way that says, I want to establish a loving relationship with you because I know I'm the most important thing to you, and there's nothing more important than you. So there are lots of practical strategies about how we can help parents get there, and there are many experts in the room in addition to myself who could tell you about some very powerful examples of
nothing
how
like
we build
telling them. A kid you love them.
Absolutely right. It's as simple and as complex as that. Okay, so let me wrap up by just talking about the fact that we have brain plasticity throughout life. And brain plasticity means that our brains are changing and growing and learning until we breathe our very last breath. I mean, literally, until we flatline, we are capable of learning. And we all know that we don't do it as well as we get older. You know, we really do have these magical moments where our DNA has equipped us to drink in certain skill sets, particularly around language and language learning. And we know that when children are spoken to, when they're sung to, when they're told stories during infancy, when their brain is wide open to learning language, they are going to be proficient readers. It's not about necessarily about vocabulary or about how many books parents read to their children. It's about storytelling. It's about engaging with children so that they hear the sounds of language. And that's something that you as a state, I think, have a corner on the rest of our nation. The First Lady mentioned that you're starting behind. Well, maybe so, but there are lessons that you can teach the rest of the nation about cultural competence and about holding on to that concept of storytelling and how vital that is to early childhood with neuroscientific research to back you up on that. So helping us, the rest of us, figure out how to weave that storytelling tradition into emerging literacy programs will be a wonderful thing that I hope you do so the rest of us can learn from that. So our brains can heal and learn throughout life, so we never give up hope, but why make it hard on ourselves? You know, if we start right at the beginning, the trajectory, the nature of our task is going to be very different. So while that plasticity in the early years, the amazing adaptability of our brains means that we can learn very easily early in life, it also means that we are vulnerable to harm and to lasting harm. It's true that children are resilient, but it's also true that we shouldn't make so many children wait so long to get in a healthy context for learning. So I won't reiterate much about the wonderful points that Rob made about how our research is teaching us that we have lifelong benefits from getting a good start in life, from all of the economic returns, and then most importantly, we're not squandering this terrific resource that we have in terms of human creativity and in terms of empathy. Voluntary programs, they're a key. You know, there's a great, in Washington State, we've just come off a very successful legislative session where a bill to create a new Department of Early Learning was created. And this was an effort to consolidate childhood programs that are scattered across a variety of departments that we really wanted to bring into one, under one roof. So I guess the last message that I just want to leave you with is that there are lessons you can learn from other states. Starting early, really from birth, will yield you huge returns, some of which are tangible, some of which are not. And you've got a really unique alchemy here in Alaska with the nature of the public-private partners that are coming together, asking for support in an appropriate way for the government to join in this remarkable effort to do right by all of your children. Thank you very much. Sorry, I went a little over time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bridget. Instead, a comment that you mentioned earlier, synaptic experience, you know, I think some of us just call it getting a clue.
Well, you can exuberantly get a clue. That counts.
Thank you. Also, I'd like the record to reflect that we have been joined by Representative Croft and Representative Jewell. Representative Wilson, do you have a quick question?
I do have a question for Bridget. Bridget, I you know, how much we communicate with our children verbally changes from one culture to another.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the culture doesn't do as much verbal communication with their children, how, you know, can we go into those areas and teach those families so that they realize that that might be hard for them to make those changes?
That's a very, very powerful question. I think first and foremost, when working with families, you really want to start from a position of honoring the culture and honoring their experience. I mean, children in those cultures learn to speak. You know, whether or not they learn to speak in the same way across all human cultures is open to question. I would say it is true that in most cultures, they do learn to speak through a face-to-face interaction, you know, where we're holding baby close and we're exaggerating the sounds of language and doing that thing we call parentese, where we go, hi, baby. And you're smiling not only because it's silly for me to sit here in a suit coat and speak that way to you, but it also evokes an emotional response. You know, it says, I care about you. You matter. And I'm going to slow my grown-up time down to baby time. And I'm going to let your brain drink in all of the gradations of how I form these sounds. And I'm going to let you see my face while I do it. And babies are riveted on human faces. So it may be that how we learn to speak language looks different in those earliest experiences. But the importance is to say, if we want our children to succeed by the time they get to school, then we know a variety of different strategies that can help get them there. And so we start by building on the strength that each culture, that each family offers. And it may well be that there are others in communities that can focus more on literacy traditions or find the trusted advocates who bring books in a way that is going to be welcoming and supportive of the good things that are already happening in those cultures. Because it is that phonemic awareness, that knowledge of an experience with sounds in infancy, you know, not how many books you've been read, that predicts your later success in school and reading.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grunewald, you addressed something that actually fascinated me something I hadn't thought about. You know, the folks in the room deserve all the credit in the world for the work you've been doing on this. And I'm already a convert on early education. We have legislation to implement an education program for early childhood. But the other thing that you mentioned was parental involvement, and you said, and I had never heard this about the Perry Preschool Program, but you said it was an early education program, but on top of that, there was a component where staff visited parents to try and get parents more involved in that. It's also a piece of legislation we have, but I'd never heard that talked in terms of early education. So can you talk about the importance of that and whether or not an early education program would need to have a parental involvement outreach component to it, and whether some of these don't, the other programs don't, and what the relative benefits are of doing and not doing the parental involvement contact part?
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'd be happy to answer that. When we looked at the early childhood studies and childhood research broadly, those programs that are center-based, such as preschool programs or high-quality childcare programs, those that are successful, a consistent component of those successful programs are that there's either a home visiting program component to it in a way that helps get the parents involved in that child's education, or there is a parent education component at the center that invites parents to that center, perhaps before they drop their child off for the preschool program or childcare setting, or afterward, and so that they get involved in some parenting activities with an actual teacher about how to parent. So that's been a very consistent component, and it addresses what Bridget talked about, that indeed parents are the child's first teacher. And when we talk about early education, it's very important to think holistically about including the parent in the activities.
Just to follow up on the parenting, parental involvement part?
Quickly, but I would like to remind the members of, and the guests of the panel here that We've got quite a few guests. We want to make sure we get through.
Then I'll pass. Thanks.
Go ahead.
No, it's all right.
Okay. Mrs. Murkowski?
Well, I just had one more comment. We've discovered that Head Start, too, has a lot of these components put in with family visits, with visiting nurses and that sort of thing, which is all very good. We also know that there are 300 villages in our state. Only 100 have the Head Start program. So that's one thing that we have to look to do, because there are a lot of kids out there who are just having nobody. With that, Ira, I think maybe I would call on you. I think if we could have the panel, or our task force group, stand if they wish, just for 2 minutes to say what we've learned and what we are trying to do here. I didn't mean you had to move.
Probably we have to try and keep our clerks like to keep track of this, so we need their names for the record.
Well, thank you. I'm Ira Perman. I'm the president of the Alaska Humanities Forum, and I and Melinda Myers have been serving as the staff for the task force. And as sort of a prologue to six people who will come behind me, I thought I'd give you a little perspective specifically to Alaska. Some statistics, not the heart that we're talking about, but some of the statistics. For the purposes of what we're talking about, early childhood we define as birth through roughly 5 years old, that time before they enter the school system, which is either kindergarten or first grade in Alaska. There's about 55,000 children in Alaska that meet that. Too many of those, of course, is what you're going to hear today, is are not coming into the school systems ready to read, ready to learn, and that's holding back our whole education system and our future. How can we tell this? Well, anecdotally, we've known it for years. You just have to talk to any kindergarten teacher, and they'll tell you within the first week at school, they can tell where that kid's going to end up when they graduate high school, and it's remarkably accurate. You can tell which are the ones that are going to be greatly, hugely successful. They're going to tell which ones are going to end up incarcerated. They can pretty well get a sense of that right in the first week of kindergarten. Well, about starting in 2002, the state started codifying this by having kindergarten teachers do what's called an Alaska developmental profile. It takes place after about a week of the kids in school, and this kindergarten teacher just simply assesses them on certain kinds of desired traits, physical health, behaviors. Let's see if this thing works here. Here we go. This is a new piece of a new chart that's collected some material from the Department of Education put out by Alaska 2020. What you see running across the bottom line there are some of those desired behaviors or traits and such things as physical well-being, fine motor, gross motor, and so on across the right. And what you can see, the tall bars are good. We're good. Physical well-being, our kids are coming into kindergarten quite healthy. They're pretty good. If you go across the top, you see speaking. They're a good talking bunch. Their gross motor, fine motor skills are good. Social development's pretty good. Approaches to learning are okay, but look at the ones that we put the yellow lines under. Mm-hmm. They're just to highlight them for you, and you can see those are the ones we're not doing so well. And those include listening, emergent reading, emergent writing, and over on the right there, problem solving. Those are your ready to read, ready to learn measurements. And if you look a little closer, you'll also see that this is the three colors are three different years. The first year, 2002, then 3, then 4. And look closely at those ones that are highlighted, and you can see that the general trend is down. And moving to this next slide, we have a little kind of close-up on this. We've added a new year. This is a new year's data added to this as well. In this case, we put in all four of the, we call the literacy skills, which includes speaking, which the kids do pretty well on, but you can see a definite direction on this whole scale here it's in the wrong direction. So we have a situation that's going from poor to even worse. One of the questions that the task force has been wrestling with are which kids in our systems are doing the worst? Which are the most at risk? We hope to someday be able to put together a chart like this that shows regionally, demographically, for this age group. We have the raw data. It's going to take us a while to put it together. What we do have right now, I'm sure you've all seen this before, this is a look at 10th graders, kids way out. This is their high school graduation qualification exam. And you've probably seen this before. To the extent that one might be able to, and by the way, in this case, the tall bars are bad. This is the failure rate, sorry. These are the failure rates on that first time they take the test. To the extent that you can extrapolate backwards from this to before kindergarten, and by the way, tests say you can, and even tests conducted here in Alaska using Alaska researchers say you can. This gives us some indication of where the need is right now. And it's not a surprise. It has a lot to do with income. Has a lot to do with limited language skills, not just English, but any language skills. If your parents are not real strong in their language, that's a real issue. That's a sort of a very gross overview of what will be an introduction to our next speakers. And of course, this is all very important. Why is this whole thing so important? Well, those kids that come into school that are not ready to learn, not ready to read, they come in behind, they tend to stay behind. You've heard that before, you'll hear it time and again. Those kids that are ready to read, ready to learn, those are the ones that succeed in school, those are the ones who succeed in life. And that's what we're looking for all of our kids, is that opportunity for them to succeed in life and have Alaska reach its greatest potential. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ira. Next, we would like to hear from David White, who's going to say a few words on the perspectives of early childhood education from the private sector.
For the record, we have been joined by Representative Croft Gardner, and I would like to recognize Commissioner Sampson in the audience also. Please proceed.
Hi, I'm David White. I recently retired last year as president and CEO of Alyeska Pipeline, and also with more than 40 years in the energy business. And I wonder what's a businessman doing on a ready-to-read task force. Hopefully we get them in that condition, but we don't. And there's a real business perspective related to it, and I think you heard that in some of the early remarks. And from my perspective, I could put it down into three essential ingredients in the business world. It's the effectiveness of your employees. I'll spend a little time on that. The retention of those employees, and then the future replacement of it. And by effectiveness, each and every one of us have seen our own ability to focus on our work and our outcomes influenced both positively and negatively by how our children are doing in the system. So it's very, very clear to me that the better prepared and the more help in getting prepared in the education system, then your employees are going to be better positioned to actually do their work, and therefore I see a big effectiveness component in that. And you saw it in terms of a lot of the behaviors that cost us socially. Well, it costs you as a business leader, too, in terms of how that parent interacts at work versus what's driving at home. Retention. Clearly, in today's world, parents think very strongly about the educational quality, availability, and the environment that their children are going to be in. We compete for that every day. If our education systems aren't delivering what we need, we're going to have a tough time keeping those people here. They'll find a better place for their families to grow up. And then in replacement, what I see is a great opportunity for jump-starting and improving the Alaskan population, and that they will be more effective, be ready for, and take more of these jobs rather than people from the outside if we have an effective early learning system. I happen to be a parent of a six-year-old. I spent a lot of time in school with him, and I see the behaviors that you heard talked about, both with my child and other children, in terms of whether they're getting this effective early learning opportunity or not. So I think there's a very strong business imperative. As a businessman, I think there's a strong financial background in terms of the state and the outcomes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, David. Next, we'd like to hear on the issues in rural Alaska Native communities from Edna McLean. Dr. McLean.
Thank you. My name is Edna Aguirre McLean. I'm Alaska Native and Inupiaq from Barrow, Alaska, and I'm President Emeritus of Ilisavi College, which is also in Barrow. The topic that I'll be talking on is issues of rural Alaska Native communities. And there are so many issues that I've, as an educator, I could focus on a lot, but I've chosen several, namely four, that I'd like to focus on today. And they're listed on the first slide, too. On the top of the list is the lack of parental involvement, meaningful parental involvement in schools. Also, teachers and school administrators who do not have a vested interest in our communities. The lack of culturally relevant curriculum. And also, too few Alaska Native students are succeeding in schools. I would say that the number one wish of many Alaska Native parents is that their children succeed in school. And under the slide of lack of parental involvement in schools, I'll cite that the parental alienation of schools in the introduction of schools has played a key role in the kinds of involvement that our parents have in our communities. There was all of that, the negative issues of rejection of language, of your knowledge, and also even removal of schools, of children from schools, has left a great deal of resentment of towards the school by many of our parents in our communities. Many of us have chosen to let that go. And I think that is crucial for moving further down the line of academic success for our children. And those Alaska Native parents who have let go of the baggage of the mistreatment in schools of their children and also of themselves are now seeking ways of helping their children succeed in schools. And one of these is to learn how to help their children improve in reading and writing and also discussions in classrooms so that they become participants in the academic achievement of children in Alaska. But also, there is a great deal of need for teacher training. The teachers also need to be able to incorporate the parental contributions in the schools. Many parents want to help, but the teachers also don't know how to use their help in the classroom. And also, under most teachers are from the lower 48 and not from our local communities. Consequently, there's a high turnover of teachers in our communities, thus limiting the advancement of many of our children in staying within the same program or under the same kind of instruction. And then also, there's a lack of culturally relevant materials in our schools based on Alaska Native knowledge. And I'd say, and there's a great deal of research that has been done to verify the fact that the inclusion of Alaska Native culture, knowledge, and language, and literacy in the curriculum provides an academic setting for Native students. I think the lack of that kind of knowledge in the classroom curriculum limits their participation for success. And the use of the ancestral language, or even the valorization of the ancestral language in the schools, empowers minority students. And that is also backed by research. When the school is honoring their language, then the students see this and feel better towards the schooling process. And also, I'd say that the incorporation of local knowledge strengthens the connections between the community and the schools and the teachers that are primarily from the lower 48 or from urban centers in Alaska. And it's a known fact, unfortunately, that many of our students are not doing well in schools. Our students that are from 7th to 12th grade comprise over 40% of the dropouts in the schooling system. And many of the 11th graders are not proficient in reading, writing, and mathematics. That is a situation that many Alaska Native parents would like to change. It needs the help of all of the various sectors of society in the state of Alaska. And it's very exciting to read about all the research that has been done on early childhood education, the research on the brain, and the kinds of interactions that parents need to do to help their child prepare for success in school. Many of the practices by the parents with their children were done in Alaska Native homes prior to the introduction of schools. There were lullabies, there were stories for children, there are all kinds of activities planned in our cultures for young children. When the schooling process began, all of that stopped because the parents wanted their children to do well in school, and much of the knowledge that was not based on research was being professed as ways of helping your children do well in school, like not speaking Eskimo or Inupiaq to your child so that they become better in English. All of that has changed because of research. What we need, what I would like to see is Alaska Native parents taking the initiative to revive a lot of their practices that they had done for young children. Storytelling, singing, and just the close interaction that used to occur between the child and the parent. And all of these issues are in the forefront. We find ourselves at the top of every bad list and at the bottom of every good list. And that's not a very good situation to be in. I think of the Alaska Native Society is at a crossroads, and this new information on research on early childhood education and brain development should spur us on to a new level of participation in education of our children. And as an administrator, I like to listen. When I focus on issues and challenges, I'd like to look for a potential solution. And based on the information that we just heard and over the information that the task force has been exposed to, I'd like to offer one potential solution, and that's to provide access to quality early childhood education for all children in both rural and urban settings. But that we also develop a statewide approach to all of this, which means the involvement of federal, state, and the district, as well as many of the organizations in each of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McLean, if I may, Mrs. Murkowski. Mm-hmm. Dr. McLean, there is, I would like to take a quick recognition of the many school districts in Alaska right now, in rural Alaska, that do participate in early education opportunities. I know I travel to a lot of the rural schools as chair of education and talk to them about that. And those are available in a lot of the programs right now, and I do commend those folks for taking that out of their budget. But could you quickly help us out on how can we as a state, I know I find it very difficult to try and have a, you'd mentioned parents teaching cultural traditions. And I know that you've tried to work on this. Could you share a little bit of what can we do to help make that happen?
We can, as a task force and me as the state government, what the parents are looking for are ways to help their children succeed in schools, from how to read to your child. How do you interact with your child with a book? What are the things, what are the questions that you ask? And then also, if the parent wants to do that type of interaction with a child in their native language, then there also needs to be a lot more development of culturally relevant materials that are in the native language. Meaning Alaska Native parents are more comfortable in interacting with their native language, and especially the grandparents who have a great deal of influence on their grandkids, and because now, like myself, they're taking care of their grandchildren more often and helping with the family unit that sometimes has to work two jobs. So more materials needs to be available in each of our homes, and also many of the young parents, maybe single mothers who have no access to early childhood learning materials, need to have someone come into their home or have easy access to books and also the information on the research that we just heard about on brain development and economic development, especially brain development for the young mothers, needs to be given to them so that they can act in an appropriate way to help their child develop.
Thank you, Dr. McLean. And may the record also reflect that we have been joined by Representative Berkowitz Kelly, and we have Carlene Jackson, the Commissioner of Hess, with us today also. Mrs. Murkowski?
Yes. Candace Winkler will be our next speaker, and she's speaking on the affordability, accessibility, and quality of early childhood education in Alaska.
Hi, I'm Candace Winkler, and I'm the CEO of Child Care Connection. We're what's called a child care resource and referral agency, and we have a network of agencies around the state that work with both parents and child care providers. We support them, we work on training issues, and we do some consultation for them. And I'm here to just give you a little bit of insight into the early care and education, the kind of formal settings that kids are spending time in, how the task force is sort of broken out as we're looking at where kids under age six spend time, and they're in families, and they're also in out-of-home placements, early care and education programs. I'm going to talk about those three components, accessibility, affordability, and quality, and they're very integrally related with one another. The first issue I'm going to talk about is accessibility. And currently, according to the U.S. Census, we have about 46,000 children under age six that have all of their parents in the workforce, meaning they either live with one parent who works or they live in a two-parent household where both parents are working. When we look at access to programs for those children whose parents are out of the home working, we see that we have, in licensed childcare, we have about 17,000 spaces, we have about 3,500 in Head Start, and we have about 1,500 in preschools that are certified. So that comes to about 22,000 spaces that are licensed or certified for that 45,000 children whose both parents are working. We know that some of those children probably have parents working, you know, swing shifts so that they can cover care, or they may have extended relatives who are helping. But we do see that there probably is some form of a gap there for the accessibility piece. And we also have probably all heard stories on the on the news about young children who are found, that something happens to those young children and they are in some form of informal, unsafe care. When we look at the affordability, I'm going to focus more of my affordability and quality sections on the child care sector because it, by and large, serves the majority of the kids in our state. When we look at affordability, what we see is that for an infant, the average rate for an infant in child care in the state of Alaska is $7,800 a year. For a four-year-old, it's $6,600 a year. Now, when you compare that with the costs of college tuition at $3,500 a year, you see that cost for infant care is about double the cost for university. And if you think about a family who has a very young child and their earning potential, and you also think about that versus parents who are sending kids to college and the amount of time you have to save to send a child to college, the scholarships that are maybe available to help send a child to college, you get a sense of how very expensive this is as a family expense. Also, there's a new report that just recently came out called Breaking the Piggy Bank that's very interesting. It's not specific to Alaska, but it is national, and it does look at cost across the nation. And it finds that across the nation for renters, the cost of childcare for two kids, one infant and one preschool-age child, the cost of childcare is more than rent on average for families. When you look at families who own, the cost of childcare as compared to their mortgage is pretty much equal across the nation, and it comprises the biggest family expense. So you see that affordability is sometimes challenging. Now I want to talk a little bit about quality, and again, all of these are tied together. You know, obviously those programs that are more expensive tend to have the higher quality, and for a lot of families, because of their income, you know, the quality becomes out of reach. But when we look at quality and what are the major factors of quality, we see that teacher training and retention of teachers is probably the number one factor in determining quality of a program. Probably the number two factor is the family involvement, and this gets to some of what Bridget's talking about. We do know that parents are our kids' first teachers, and we do think that kids who can stay home with their parents and have an engaged loving parents, that that's, you know, that's a really very healthy model. But what we also know is we have a large number. I told you the number, the 45,000 number of kids whose parents are working. And so we do know that the reality is we have a lot of kids that are in programs. And so that's why looking at quality indicators becomes so very important. Again, teacher training and retention being the number one factor in quality, what we also know is that we have a real problem in teacher training and retention, and a lot of it is due to the wages. Child care providers make on average $9 an hour, and when we look at what programs are doing, you know, we look at the high cost that parents are paying, and we see that parents probably can't pay a whole lot more. Then we go down and we look at programs and we say, how are programs spending their resources? And we see that programs are spending on average 70% of their budgets on their personnel expenses, and yet their staff are making $9 an hour. So you see that there's a real economic problem here, and it's no wonder why we have turnover rates in the child care sector of around 45% here in the state of Alaska. And when you think about the stuff that Bridget Chandler talked about and the relationship that needs to happen with young kids and how that is how the children learn is through that relationship, and you think about that kind of a turnover rate, think about how devastating that would be in a kindergarten classroom or a first grade classroom. And the younger the child is, the more impactful that turnover is on quality and their learning. Now, there are some things that are happening in the state. There are a lot of folks that are committed to trying to work on quality issues, and there are a lot of things that we can do to try to improve the quality, and we can look at what other states are doing. And some of those things are some of the things that you'll hear about through the $750,000 earmark that we had. One of them is called a quality rating system. That's one way to evaluate quality of programs. It helps parents make better choices about quality of programs. And frankly, as parents can make better choices, it drives the market more towards quality. So that's a really important thing that other states are doing. And that we've begun here in this state and would like to continue. The other thing that states are really investing is they're investing in their teachers. They're investing in training, and they're investing in retention. And those are projects that we've also begun working on professional development. But again, it's something that we need to continue to build on to build a supply of affordable, accessible, and high-quality child care for our children whose parents are working. So thank you.
Thank you, Candace. I went out of order a little bit, and so we now have John Davis, who's the chair of the Alaska Association of School Administrators, and he will be speaking on the link between early childhood development, early childhood education, and the K-12 public education. Thanks, John.
Good afternoon. I am John Davis, Superintendent, Bering Strait School District, and now I am the past president of AASA. Thank you, Representative Newbin, members of the committee, and particularly First Lady, Ms. Murkowski. As an educator, there's really not a whole lot more that I'm going to add that has already been said. We do know the cost of bringing in children who are significantly behind. We do know the issues and the challenges of what happens to a child who is not at grade level after third grade. Many of these things you've heard yourself. What I do want to talk with you about today is not so much the causes of children who have fallen behind, not so much the issues that are impacting our school district, our society, community as a whole, as a result of that. What I'd like to talk with you about is that I'm an example of public policy. I suspect you are all as well. Someone made an investment at me at one point in time, helped me get through 12th grade, eventually through college. And as a public policy person for the state of Alaska, I was helped and supported getting various advanced degrees while I was here in the state, and have returned in order to make good on that that investment. That investment now over 30 years in the making to bring me to this particular point and juncture, and that is to participate on this task force with exactly the group of people that I'd hoped that we would be involved with in impacting public policy, more specifically children in Alaska. And that is, I'm not here as an educator asking you for more money or more program. I'm here asking you as the father of Ann and Claire, who were in elementary school at this time, as a father, as a community member, that this investment that we're looking at is a significant issue to the state of Alaska, not just in human capital, but in issues of economic diversity and ultimately in the security of democracy, not just in this state, but hopefully within the country at large. The issue to me is not so much who and what has not done this or that. We can point to the individual, and we often do when things go a failure. In our business, we say, I earned an A, you gave me a D. In public policy, we often look for, why has parent not done this? Why has school district not done that? Why has legislature not done this? What I would like to challenge you is to participate in this task force and the support of this task force and saying, okay, we can identify very succinctly and probably very clearly and maybe a little too judgmentally at times why something has not gone well or why something has not occurred as we'd most hope. What I'd like you to participate in this challenge is that what is it we need to do to figure out how do we educate those who are most in need of education? How do we educate those who are most challenged by it? We can identify fairly clearly through assessment, and we have assessment galore at this point in time. And I can tell you just almost by zip code who's going to do well and who's not going to do well. Okay, again, the issue is not identifying who's not going to do well and who's going to do well. The issue is how do we make sure everyone does well? We all prosper when that happens. So I don't have, and I won't pretend to have, the answers. I do know that in my own business, the field of education, we have slowed to move and make the changes that are necessary in order to teach all children. As a community of people, we've been significantly slow in making those changes as well. I think many of the efforts at pointing towards educational reform are misguided and are not going to lead us to where we want to be. I won't debate that issue with you today, and I won't find fault with you at this point. But I think that is slowing down our initiative. I don't think that's going to get us to where we want to go. So I stand before you as an educator who's been at this over 30 years saying, we need to figure this out. Not because I've been doing a lousy job, that may be true. Not because you haven't been very supportive, that may or may not be true. But that's not the point. The issue must be, how do we figure this out so that the students that we work with, the children who are going to subsidize Social Security, if you might, those who are going to be the law enforcement, those who are going to be the future politicians, have the skills necessary in order to maintain those of us who may be only on ventilators and breathing tubes at that point in time. But nonetheless, hopefully they'll do it in a very kind and gentle way. I'll leave it at that and say thank you. Again, my interest is that you participate in this effort along with the groups of people that you find behind me. And they are not educators. They are truly a cross-section of people. And if truly a cross-section of people have come to the conclusion that education of early childhood children is a requisite, then it's probably well overdue and long necessary in our community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. And if I may interject real quick, Mr. Davis suggested that we be available to work with him, but I was already have a note here to ask the members here to make sure that I will talk to them and see if they can come back and talk to our committee a little bit further in some more of their perspective fields. That I would certainly welcome that, and please contact my office. We can arrange that. Mrs. Mikulski.
And our final panelist will be speaking on what the philanthropic sector can and see and do. And I guess we've had a change. And it's
There's two more.
Sharon. How did I miss Sharon? It's because Catherine, you're taller. Okay. I'm sorry, Sharon Gagnon. It's just my eyesight. Improving early childhood literacy within the family's family reading, library, and health clinic program. Sharon Gagnon. Sorry, Sharon.
Thank you, Mrs. Mikulski. I'm Sharon Gagnon. I'm past president of the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska, and past president of the Board of Overseers at Harvard. Past chair of the Alaska Humanities Forum, current vice chair of the Siri Foundation, and vice chair of the University of Alaska Foundation, and grandmother. So you know why I'm involved in this. Education has been my life, and now my grandchildren are coming along, so I'm more than interested in the whole concept of early childhood literacy. And I also come from a very deep feeling that, as we all know, the greatest influence on a child is the family. For better or for worse, that your family is where your influence is. And so the family literacy is the piece of the puzzle that interests and intrigues me the most. And that is, we know that some families are doing terrifically in interacting with their children and promoting all the skills that will lead to success in school. But we also know that some families aren't doing so well. Families who perhaps for whom English is not their first language, and they don't have access or skills or abilities to operate in a society where English is the first language. Families where their parents' own literary skills aren't as great as they could be. Families where their stress is so great that there isn't a lot of time to spend with the children for whatever reason. So how do we create the opportunities and the activities that will reach these families to help foster in them the ability, the knowledge, and the time to interact with their children and promote these literacy skills that we find so important? There exist, and these are usually off hours, after school, after work kind of activities that are called the family literacy programs. Now, there are family literacy programs that do exist within the regular structures. There's Even Start, which is already in the state of Alaska in very limited areas, but which works through existing structures. Head Start is one of them, and Head Start has its own programs along those lines. However, there have been other states who have and other entities who have developed programs that have been very successful, and some of these have had pilots going on in Alaska. Some of them are going on right now, but it's very, very scattered, very sparse, very shotgun approach to how things are done. And they're usually, for example, there was a primetime reading program which took place in the Kenai Peninsula, which everyone agreed was terrific. It lasted 1 year, and there was no more funding. That was the end of it, and it went on. A primetime is one that works through libraries. So we have a great library system in this state. That would be an opportunity there. There's a program, Mother Read, Father Read, which, for example, the state of Connecticut is putting in many cities. New Haven, I think, has I don't know how many already of these Mother Read, Father Read programs, which instead of involving the children in the process as primetime does, instead trains the parents on how to read, how to interact with the kids. So in any event, there are all these programs out there. Some of them have been in Alaska already, more probably than I even know about. So what are we going to do about this? And I think that this is one of the roles of this task force, to work with the state and with other entities, and that is to find out what is going on in family literacy, per se, right now. What programs are working? What could work? How we can work in partnership to get family literacy programs in place to make that first early exposure, that first early influence, a good one for both the families and the children.
Thank you, Sharon.
Ms. Sharon?
Catherine? Yes, please, finally.
Kathy.
Hello, I'm Catherine, Kathy Rasmussen, and with the Rasmussen Foundation. I'm the seventh speaker, so after me you can get your seventh inning stretch. I would also like to add my appreciation for all of you being here for this presentation, because we feel that it's a very critical, important time in the state to really become part of this and take hold of it. We're talking about the future of our young Alaska residents, and we don't want to be behind the curve anymore. I'm a grandmother of three, so I've become very passionate about ready to learn, ready to read, because I've always loved reading to my children, cuddling up to them, and now I'm doing it to my grandchildren, and they absolutely adore me. So I just think it's great. As a little history, Jenny and E.A. Rasmussen came to Alaska over 100 years ago as missionaries. They taught grade school, Sunday school, and taught music lessons to Alaskans young and old. They fed the body, the mind, and the soul. The Rasmussen Foundation has just celebrated its 50th anniversary, and our mission has not changed. It has just grown and adapted to the changes in Alaska. Numerous studies have been done, research is available from all the other states, so the time for action is now. I believe we can meet the challenge and opportunities to impact early childhood literacy and learning by doing three things: coordinate, collaborate, and engage the community. Our work with the foundation takes us to all corners of Alaska. We are a major player in the library in Haines. They wisely had the foresight to design a child center in the library for the daycare, preschool, and kindergarten classes, and it works beautifully. Libraries in Copper Valley, Dillingham, Nanana, and Unalaska have also received grants, and we get glowing letters back from them about how helpful it has been to for us to add books to their collection and computers and other programs. We've given grants to Nome, Togiak, Koweric for their preschool programs. So you can see we've been around the state. We can develop coordination between businesses, state, and federal programs and the philanthropic sector. I believe the legislature can look at the big picture of the rating systems and guidelines of child care and preschools, public information campaigns, etc. Coordination with existing agencies and programs can be enhanced to bring them to everyone. Working with businesses and foundations can produce the capital needed as well as the leaders and the staff to help these programs function. We need to collaborate. This is an area where the Rasmussen Foundation shines. We have invited outside foundations to Alaska for the past several years and have brought in millions of dollars to various communities and nonprofit organizations. I would say for every dollar the Rasmussen gives out, we're bringing in about $3 from outside to complement that. We will continue to develop these relationships to benefit Alaskans. It will take ingenuity, hard work, and negotiation skills to improve collaboration between business, state, and foundations. The leaders are here, you and the rest of us on the task force. We're here and we're ready. Community. I believe it is our duty to treat everyone in Alaska as our neighbor. We need to recognize that what works for the larger cities will not necessarily transfer to smaller villages. It is important to be proactive and use this new scientific information on the learning patterns of young children. If we are going to be reactive to the problems that arise later, it will just cost us more, and we've already seen that. The vast distances that separate Alaskans, be it geographic, economic, or cultural, is a challenge that we are capable of meeting. We can shrink those distances. Ladies and gentlemen, I think if we can put our egos aside and work together, the solutions are right in front of us. We're investing in our future. Thank you.
I personally would like to thank you, Ms. Rasmussen, and I know I speak for the members of this committee, for all the work that the Rasmussen Foundation has done throughout Alaska, and there's no doubt in your commitment to education in Alaska. And in fact, this week I have met with members of your committee and ongoing discussions of what we can do to help Alaska and their vocational education opportunities throughout Alaska, and we will continue those discussions, and I continue that conversation with your committee. Thank you for what you've done.
Thank you.
Mr. Mikulski.
That is all of our panelists now, but I think if any of the committee here has any questions of the panelists, or maybe the panelists have some questions of you.
And I would like to remind the members of this committee also that our chair of Hess, Representative Wilson, will be hosting this committee again at 3:45 to 4:15 today for further questions, and hopefully they'll be around mingling amongst us here so we can talk with them on a one-on-one basis, which is always an interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
Also, before we adjourn here today, I'd like to make sure that we thank the folks from Silver Bow Bagels for our free lunch. Mom always got through there, you know, never leave without saying thank you for a free lunch, so we did know that. And just to continue on with this discussion, next week on Tuesday in the Education Committee, we're going to be hearing from Stephanie Clothier. Stephanie is from the National Conference of State Legislators, and she's going to be here to present some more early education opportunities and what different states are doing, what type of legislation could be carried or introduced, I want to continue while this ball is rolling here, while we have the momentum on it, and I just want to make sure that members are here for that. Also, I cannot forget the many guests that we have in the audience today. I'm trying to do a rough count here, and I would guess well over 75, very well attended, not just by members of all of Alaska, but members of our legislative body from both bodies and both sides of the aisle, a very cooperative effort, and I think it's very recognized the importance of early education opportunities. Did we have any other questions from our committee? Representative Dahlstrom?
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I would like to thank those of you that served on the task force, and Mrs. Murkowski. I can honestly say this is one of the best hour and a half time slots I have spent since I have been here in Juneau, and I wish to compliment you on your work, and you have my commitment that I will do what I can to work with you. I'm a parent of four, grandparent of three, and have seen the results of children that don't have the wonderful things that many other children do have, and thank you so much for your work.
That's not a banquet, just a reception. Thank you. Representative Dahlstrom, and we're not finished yet. I mean, we still have work to do. We know that, but our mission is clear. We want every child to be able to be ready, as I say, not ready to learn necessarily, but ready. What did I say? I said that backwards. Mm-hmm. Not just necessarily ready to read, but ready to learn. And the impact is in those years and months between age 0 to 6, and that's what we're working on now. As an afterthought. We've invited our task force members and the NEA members and the legislative body, whoever can make it, to a reception from 4:30 to 6 at the mansion. And then at 6, everybody has to leave to get back to Anchorage. But thank you all for your time and your commitment. I'm taking that as a commitment.
It is.
Okay, great. Was there anything else?
No, Mrs. Murkowski, and again, just thank you to all the presenters, and particularly to Mrs. Murkowski. I know this is one of her projects that she's worked on for many years, and she's very involved in educational issues, and I know she'll continue to be a strong proponent for education in many years to come. And thank you, Mrs. Murkowski.
Well, I have 13 grandchildren. Thank you all for coming.
And with that, we will end today's meeting.